Welcome to another edition of BARTcast, a podcast series curated by Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries. Learn more at bcm-net.org.
Dr. Ridley is a Kitoa Cherokee Distinguished Professor of Faith and Culture at Portland Seminary, where he is also Director of Intercultural and Indigenous Studies. He's also married to an amazing woman with silver hair, just like me. Randy has authored a number of books with which we hope you will make yourselves familiar. Randy is a pastor, an activist, a farmer, and a movement builder. He's someone who's working for change of both church and society. Randy, a very, very warm welcome to you, and perhaps there's a way that you'd like to introduce yourself.
Oh, thank you for that opportunity. I just want to make an opening statement, and that is that it is rather ironic that I'm on the last of your webinars, and we have the last of the Mohicans and the end of the trail, and Ishii the last of his tribe, and so it's probably appropriate to bring a Native American on to close this thing out. So.
Yeah. All right, Ishii, go for it.
Yeah, so I'm just open to your questions, and we'll talk about what you want to talk about. That's good. Thank you for having me, though. I'm honored to be a part of your world. We have a lot of mutual friends, and they all keep saying, you know, you guys got to get together with Ched and Elaine, and we never have, and so at some point we need to do that. So.
All right. Well, let's start with your lived context. Tell us a little bit about Ailuhe Farm, if I didn't butcher that pronunciation, which is where you and Edith do your work. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Edith and I have been in ministry together. I like to say service now. It's got a little bit better ring to it these days, have been in service to our fellow human beings together since she married into it in 1989. I've been in doing things a little longer, but it was only in Kentucky in 2004 that we really started a farm, Ailuhe Farm. Mm-hmm. And Ailuhe is that one of those kind of universal words in our Kitoa language. It means basically the old biblical construct of shalom is this: not at war, everybody's fed, the land's producing everything it should, and all that sort of thing. And so Ailuhe is that place of harmony. And we started our farm on 50 acres in Kentucky, and then moved from there in 2008, and came to Oregon, and then it took us about 5 years to sort of get financially reconstructed, and then we were able to finally purchase a little 3¾-acre farm in Kentucky, where we've developed it. It's a lot of permaculture principles, biomimicry, traditional indigenous knowledge, and we have our own seed company that it's a nonprofit farm, so everything goes back into the farm. So and we've been experimenting with a lot of different native varieties for a while. So it's a lot of fun and a lot of work.
Mm. Yeah, we know that. A picture of a sweat lodge here. Do you want to talk a little bit about how you welcome people onto Ailuhe Farm and the kind of spiritual practices that you're nurturing there?
Yeah, these are photos are some of our community members. We have I always say that we're part of an unintentional community, very disorganized and a happenstance. But we meet once a month, and we have our sweat lodges in the wintertime when it's really rainy. We have talking circles, and people come. Everybody's welcome. Anybody who wants to come, comes. And we have other events that go on. We had a Claire Hitchens concert and work day last week. Seth Martin, a friend of mine, comes every now and then, and we have concerts and we do things together. And our sweat, I've been running sweat for 27 years. And this year, actually, speaking of the last of, so in August was my last public sweat as a sweat leader. And I passed it down to my two sons, my grandson's father, and my nephew, the Navajo guy in the picture standing next to my wife there in the center. You know, there's a time for doing things, and there's a time for passing them down to others to learn and to take up this life. So it was a commemoration of 27 years of leading that ceremony. It was good.
Wonderful. When we first were talking, Randy, before all the participants came on, you mentioned the farm in Kentucky and some of the issues that arose there. Can you tell us a little bit about how that all happened?
Yeah, so we love Oregon. I mean, for us, Oregon just fits us perfect. We're planning on staying there forever. And we didn't come there voluntarily in every sense of the word. We were forced out of Kentucky. So we had a 50-acre farm and a community, as I was saying, kind of trying to create a sort of a native ministry school, a combination between Francis and Edith Schaefer's Labrie, where you come and you work and you go to school. And then we have periodic schools and also the Highlander School, Miles Horton's place up there for, helping to mobilize activism and community development and those kinds of things. And so it was being very successful. Every school we had, we were having 40 to 50 people come in from all over the United States and Canada. About half of those were Native Americans, about half were non-Native. And of the non-native half, about a quarter of the total or half of them were people who were in ministry among Native Americans. So we felt like we were having quite an effect in the Native world, which needed some change. And we ended up running into, we had about a dozen people living in our community. We had a couple elders who were there and basically were able to speak into everyone's life there, and they were there most of the time. But eventually we ran into problems with the city or the community county commission and county planning, I guess that's what it was, and our neighbors. And they showed up at a final approval of some of our community buildings because we were in sleeping buildings. We were trying to find more places for people to sleep. And a neighbor showed up in protest, about 40 of them, and said these terrible things about us and Native Americans. Basically the county denied our permits. And then the next day, one of those neighbors was hosted a paramilitary white supremacist group. And they set up a 50 caliber machine gun on our property line and commenced to fire that daily. First, we thought they were shooting at us. Then we called the sheriff, said, oh, they're firing on their property line, but they're set up right on our property line, right? And we were concerned that there's a lot of rocks around and things. We were concerned someone was going to get killed and our livestock would be killed. We spent about 3 weeks sort of in trepidation trying to figure out what to do. And I had taken on counties and cities before. I'd taken on the good old boy network of sort of more of the citizens council, white supremacist type folk. But this, I just felt like I didn't want to take a chance with one of us getting killed, one of my children getting killed. With 50 calibers, a big bullet. And so we finally, after 3 weeks, we put up a for sale sign on everything that we had built on our schools. And they stopped the firing. It took us 2 years to sell. It was in the bottom of the economic downturn. And we ended up getting half of what the property was worth, half of the appraised value. and got just enough to get out of debt and move to Oregon. And then it took us about, I think we were sort of underemployed for about 5 years until we finally could buy this rundown, beaten up. It had been 20 years since it was a farm fixer-upper, and we've been working on that now for 6 years. And it's finally starting to get to the place where we're pretty happy about how things are going. Yeah. That's kind of our, well, I guess that's how you become a professor at in Portland, Oregon. I don't know.
Right.
And there's we've got one of our viewers tonight is from Lexington, Kentucky. Jeremy, he's visited LOA and is shouting out to you there. But that's an amazing story. So let's go deeper back into history for a minute. And let me ask you. obviously, you remember. The 92 Columbus quincentenary. I'm curious in your own journey whether that was any kind of a significant event for you, what you were doing during that time, what your thoughts were as you remember back in 1992.
Yeah, I definitely do. I wish I could say I was doing more. I was wearing t-shirts, protest t-shirts at that time and bumper stickers. I want to go back to maybe to 1982, a little farther, right? 1973 at the Wounded Knee occupation. That was when I sort of got radicalized, and then in 1975 I became a follower of Jesus. And what I was told at that time by people who loved me dearly and who I love was to don't worry about all that ending stuff. Just do what we're doing, you know, just do like us. And so I had some wilderness years. And in 1984, now 10 years before the quincentennial, I went to Alaska as a missionary among Native Alaskans and Aleuts and others, and for 2 years, and I call those my missionary oppressor years. I figured out at that point I came to a crisis of faith and figured out that I was oppressing these Native kids in the same way that my ancestors were oppressed by missionaries, and so I decided at that point to go to seminary. And I drove 5,000 miles from Kodiak, Alaska, to Eastern Baptist Theological Seminary, now called Palmer, where I had some great instruction and a great community with folks like Ron Sider and Tony Campolo and Samuel Escobar and Monfred Brock, just wonderful, wonderful people, and had some great, everything I did there was to answer the question, how do I live as a follower of Jesus and express my faith among my native people without being an oppressor. And at the end of that time, I felt like I found that. I hit the ground with my feet running. I was the became the coordinator with the American Baptists at that time. I was ordained with American Baptists of the Oklahoma Indian American Baptist Churches, 10 native churches, and I ran a community center in a very poor neighborhood, literally just on the other side of the tracks. Anadarko is called Indian Capital of the Nation. There are 17 tribes within a 40-mile radius, and that's where I got my baptism. And and that's where I also ran into all my first brick walls, both in the missionized churches and in the communities of good old boys who did not want to see change in their communities. Yeah. And so that was in 1989, and I was there to 1992. At that point, we had started a group called Christians for Justice and took on the county sheriff. We took on the city council. We took on the county. Anadarko at that time was 58% people of color and only 3% in the workforce. So we had a big job ahead of us. We had a the National Council of Churches come down and do a story video, and they showed things like the Redskin Theater, Step and Fetch It convenience store, which is right outside the Black community, and just sort of revealed what was really going on there. At that point, we began to get a lot of death threats, people following us home with their lights off, on our tails, in their cars. And at the same time, a person who was trying to get me to become a dean of students at the Indian College in Muskogee, Bacon Indian College. And that was right around the Columbus quincentennial. At that point, I was going through a lot of persecution myself and holding things like controversial seminars and things that would get people yelling and screaming and walking out. And, you know, and this was all about whether we could practice our culture within a church context, you know. And at the same time, we had these doing a lot in the community. We had things going for unwed mothers, baby clothes closet. We had language classes, after-school tutoring, basketball leagues. We had, all these different kinds of things, sweat lodge, hosting powwows, holding Indian youth camps. So we were pretty active during that time trying to be indigenous. And I think skipped over, but immediately afterwards, I don't know if you guys ever seen the video Columbus Didn't Discover Us that came out right afterwards. So I've shown that in my classes and to groups, you know, ever since that came out, and wish I could have been more socially aware at the time, but I was active standing up for Indigenous rights as we always have been since we've been in service.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That sounds like you had your hands full. Let me just pause there and go back a little further. Your Cherokee roots are North Carolina or Oklahoma or a bit of both or a third provenance.
The third way. So
okay.
All my ancestors on my mother's side, both of my parents are mixed blood Cherokees. I'm listed only as 3/16 blood quantum, and I hate to even bring up blood quantum because it's a colonial device, right? But so in my tribe, the United Ketuah Band of Cherokee Indians, you have to be 1/4. So I just miss it, mm-hmm. And so I'm considered what's called a legal descendant of the United Ketuah Band. My wife is actually a member of the Eastern Shoshone. She's a member raised on a reservation, but I'm an almost. And sometimes that creates a powerful motivation to get things done. And so most of my ancestors, not all, but I don't know of all of them, but most of my ancestors are what we call old settlers. And they were people who came out between generally... My third great grandfather signed the first peace treaty with the United States at a place called White's Fort in what is now Knoxville, Tennessee. That was the Treaty of 1791 after a 19-year war against him and other chiefs and others. He was one of 41 chiefs who signed that. The Chickamauga War, which is something people should look up because they keep claiming the Afghanistan War is the oldest war in United States history, and the Chickamauga War was 19 years. So after that, and you know, we don't have time to go into all the details of that war, but they signed the peace treaty. My grandfather was moved 5 different times from different places after he said they could be somewhere else. Finally, he moved out in 1817. Signed the Treaty of the Western Cherokee out in where the old settlers were. And basically anybody who came in the early 1800s to 1835 is considered what we call an old settler or Western Cherokee at that time. Later, the Treaty Party came, and then finally the National Party, which was the Trail of Tears. and they had three governments, and they had to solve those problems. And so a lot of the Kituas are old settlers.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that. And, you know, for our listeners who aren't familiar with the politics of bloodlines in Native America, you just alluded to that very briefly, but, you know, a lot of folks don't realize the way that the government plays that. Maybe you could just say a word about the politics of bloodlines.
Yeah, by and large, what was dictated to most of the tribes were that you had to be a certain blood quantum, and usually it stands at a quarter for most tribes. There are also requirements that you be on certain roles, that you have ancestors on certain roles. All of these are sort of made up devices that will eventually create the end, the extinction of Native people. And so it's a colonial tool. We use it because we're full of, as Native people, a lot of us, and especially our tribal governments, are full of this colonial pattern and self-hatred. It's hard to see, but they've been taught to do BIA politics, Bureau of Indian Affairs, BIA. We kind of say it, BIA stands for Boss Indians Around. But the Bureau of Indian Affairs sort of taught them how to, the bureaucracy involved, and so they stay in that pattern. They're much like a lot of our churches. You know, we get stuck in that colonial pattern and can't seem to find our way out.
Yeah, it's a great analogy, and I think a very very true one. So that brings us back now to pick up the thread of your story. So the quincentenary, you're doing a lot of ministry over the last 25 years. Obviously, you've been on a journey. You've plugged into the various kinds of Native activism that have been flourishing in various parts of North America over the last 25 years. What parts of the movement have you resonated with most? Any particular influences that you want to name in your own work?
Yeah, so I'm a more or less a teacher, a writer, a speaker, and an influencer. And so I've spent a lot of time with people making roads of influence. So there's a number of folks who have influenced me. I would say number one has been the elder John Mohawk. John was a Seneca leader, well-known, part of UNDRIP in its early days. He used to publish the Akwesasne Notes. I used to receive that when I was in high school. It was sort of our
great own. Great stuff. Yeah. I remember that very well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, talking about decolonizing, talking about farming, talking about, you know, food sovereignty and all these kinds of things. And I just found him to be a genius. Unfortunately, I never got to meet him, but have read everything and saw every video I can. And I have appreciated John Mohawk more than anyone else in terms of their influence in my thinking and my life. And so I want to give him credit for that. I've had other elders along the way. I've been really fortunate to be exposed to early on to a lot of elders who were what I call the old elders, who took the time to listen, who were pretty non-judgmental, who most of them, their parents were born in teepees. They're sort of the first generation out of the teepees type, at least for those plains people. And had other elders in my life who I was able to listen to and learn from. So I've been real fortunate. They are, our elders are the repository of knowledge. That's who I would say I'd look to. Of course, we were proponents of Standing Rock, but we couldn't, we've been fairly poor for a number of years, and weren't able to get out there. And then when we could, we didn't have the time. So But we wrote a lot and blogged a lot and Facebooked a lot. I just turned my Facebook page into a blog. I got tired of doing blogs. And if you want to know what I think, you just go through my Facebook page. Writing articles on the doctrine of discovery and speaking about the doctrine of discovery and, you know, all of those kinds of things that I get the opportunity to do. I'm currently, this morning, I was writing another article for, I think, the Covenant Church. I wrote a couple for the Mennonites, the Canadian Mennonites, and so spoke to the Presbyterians. I'm somebody who will basically go wherever people will listen, so I'm not partial.
Can you also talk about UNDRIP and how that influenced you and the work you're doing and the directions it pulled you in?
Yeah, that's a lot of work and a lot of meetings and a lot of things that I would never have the patience to do, but I'm sure glad that there are others who would sit down and have those committees. And I'm about I have about as much patience for bureaucracy as I do sitting in a room full of mosquitoes. So I'm glad that the work of UNDRIP and what they've accomplished, and now basically the word just needs to get out so people understand what it's about. And I think we're totally undereducated on things like that. Even Standing Rock, I mean, Standing Rock for so long, it was just, you know, a few of us, you know, watching through people like, you know, Amy Goodman and others, Democracy Now! And a few other folks who showed up and bothered to say something about it. I think Lawrence O'Donnell and MSNBC and a couple others. But it wasn't until they let the dogs out and the security firm sort of stepped over the line before it started getting any publicity whatsoever. So it's never a surprise to us that people don't know what's going on. We're used to that. You know, people call Native Americans the invisible minority. There's a wonderful pamphlet or study that was done here in Portland. Portland's actually the 11th largest Native community in the United States. And so it's quite active. My son was active as a youth speaker and others at NAYA, Native American Youth and Family Center. In Multnomah County, which is the bulk of where most of the natives live, we all showed up in our regalia, and my son got to speak. I was very proud of him about Indigenous Peoples Day, and they turned Columbus Day into Indigenous Peoples Day as well. They have this brochure that they put out, and the title of it is called Making the Invisible Visible. And so I think that's sort of the era that we are in is to let people know what Native people have been going through. None of this stuff is new to us. It's just new to everybody else. Yeah.
Right. Well, and that makes me think about the, you know, the Canadian, I am from Canada, the big, Canadian Truth, National Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission feels like Canadians cannot claim to not know the history, at least of Indian residential schools in Canada, yet, I mean, there is still so much ignorance. Do you see any bubblings of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission here in the United States? Around issues that of indigenous history?
So I'm appreciative of Canada's attempt with the TNR to bring these things to light. But, and I can't remember the judge's name who spoke at one point.
Murray Sinclair?
Yeah.
Maybe the commission head?
Yeah. And I listened to Murray Sinclair say, we're not quite at truth, and this isn't reconciliation. Right. We were never conciled to begin with. And so I think the concept is still a little bit weak. I'm not sure a truth. And in South Africa, it happened, but yet what happened as a result? You know, education, that's good. But I think we need more than education. And so I'm not sure the TNR is the model I would like to see happen here. So I think what we need is some more active steps. I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. We could start with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But I think it has to lead to something more for it to mean anything. People in the United States are so abstract and sort of dualistic in terms of how they understand knowledge and what they do with it. They think that they know something, that they've lived it, as opposed to actually living out what they know. And I think that that's the problem. It's the problem in the church. It's the problem just in with the citizenry. And just because you know of something doesn't mean you really know it. You don't know it until you live it out.
Thank you. Yeah, I'd like to ask, and I know we're getting close to time, I'd love to hear about NAITS and how that all got started and your work there.
Yeah, so funny you should ask. So we started in...
There's an alumnus on the call, on the webinar tonight.
Oh, yeah.
Josh Grace is listening in from Philadelphia.
Yeah, Joshua. Yeah, hey, Joshua. He's just one of my favorite people altogether.
Ours so too. We've had some,
okay, good. We've had some incredible students. I see Mickey Jones there, one of our graduates. Joshua's a graduate. We've got some incredible people who I believe are just world changers in their locales and in their sphere of influence. So I'm very pleased with the people who have come through this Master of Arts Intercultural Studies program. So we started by the four of us, Richard Twiss, myself, Terry LeBlanc, and Ray Aldred, attending Asbury Seminary. They had offered us scholarships. They wanted to get in on what we were doing. And the idea was to turn our knowledge into a sort of a program that others could follow without jumping through the hoops, or as we like to call it, hegemonic bullshit. So we learned that word in seminary, the first one. So and Asbury sort of fell apart. We tried to get a Sioux Falls seminary to pick it up, and they kind of bit for a while and then stopped. And then finally I was given an opportunity to do some adjunct work at George Fox Seminary at that time. Now it's called Portland Seminary. But and so I began to talk to them about hosting our Master of Arts Intercultural Studies that we had drawn up, and to make that dream a reality. And so we finally got some white paper going and got some signatures and started the program. I was the program director, and we've had that going for a number of years. I think we've got probably about 15, 16 graduates right now. And I just this year resigned as the director of the program, and as the basically as a professor there. So I'm still teaching at Portland Seminary, but I'm just no longer doing the NAITS program.
Well, we know from several friends how powerful that experiment has been, and as people who ourselves are involved in experimental theological education, we so deeply appreciate the way in which you all have pushed out the boundaries of what is possible, and that brings us to our final.
Yeah, well, I just want to say that it's really the great students that make it a great program. It really is. I give a lot of credit to them.
Yeah, that's for sure. Before you have to go off and do your legitimate teaching, I do want you to speak a little bit about this most recent engagement. I understand that you were one of the authors of this declaration in the wake of Charlottesville. What can you tell us about this And what are you? How are you hoping that people on this webinar might help spread this movement?
Yeah, so I'm very proud of this. I think it was drafted originally by started with Trey Lyons, and then a number of four or five other folks sort of contributed, and they all happened to be white. And then all of a sudden, they said, you know, we can't be the guardians of this thing, and so they asked, they brought in a number of us folk of color who are activists, people who have influence and educators and others, academics. And I think there were maybe eight or nine of us and just heavily edited that document drafted and edited it for close to 3 weeks maybe before it was released last Tuesday. We ended up with, I think, in 3 days, we ended up with 1,500 signatures of leaders all over. I'm not sure where it's at now, but what we would love is if people would go there, send that link, post it on Facebook, and especially don't neglect to look at the call to action there. We have one of the, on the website, you'll see one that says action. That's the most important part. And in answer, Elaine, to your Truth and Reconciliation Commission question, I would say that those four things are the most important things that would have to be done with Native people or in anything else. And so we took some time and said, what are four very practical things that people can do to really grasp a change in this? And so they were basically to listen, and we're suggesting things like listening conferences, national, local, regional, to lament, to repent, to do the opposite direction, and to reimagine a new a sort of beginning, reimagine whiteness in America and what that would mean without as a colonizing force and oppressing force. And so there's a number of really practical steps there, as well as the undergirding theological work. So we really want the word to get out. We want to see this implemented.
So we do want to ask everybody on this webinar tonight to go to this site and take a look at the declaration. It's long, it's substantive. Read it thoughtfully and carefully and sign on, as Elaine and I have. This is one of several current events in faith-based circles in response to Charlottesville, but it's an important one. And as soon as we found out that Randy was on this train, we hopped right on, because we have so much love and respect, Randy, for your work over the years, your journey, and the way that it's continuing, the way that you are incarnating your holistic faith and witness to the gospel and to humanity there at LOA. And we're just so grateful that you were able to take time out of your schedule to join us on this webinar. I want to just turn it back to you. I know you got to get ready for class, but anything you want to say by way of closing out your comments or benediction or anything else?
Yeah, I would just say that I think I'm glad you ended with the theological declaration, because this really would create a sea change in the way things are done, in the church at least. And I think, you know, it's about time the church got out ahead of stuff rather than sort of behind and reacted to. So this would mean something. Take and use that declaration in your courses, use it in your churches, use it in your Sunday school, and talk about this, because it will expose a lot of things that people probably haven't given a whole lot of thought to. And so I really want people to, I just really want to push that as something extremely important right now. And thank you guys. Thank you, Elaine and Chet, for having me on. It's an honor to be in your space for just a little bit. And I hope that this won't be the last time that we're able to get together, and maybe in person next time. So thank you.
Yes. Here's hoping.
Yeah, thanks so much, Randy.
Many blessings to you, brother.
Thank you. Blessings to you.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to the BartCast, produced by Bartimaeus Cooperative Ministries. To find our resources or to donate to support the BartCast, please go to chedmyers.org. Thank you for listening.